Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. Sitting across from me is Gary LeMaster.
No longer silent.
No longer silent, particularly since I forgot at home all the notes and the printouts that I usually made. So I'm going to depend on Gary to be the brains of this whole program.
Wow, are you in trouble.
Mike was afraid to come on with the two of us, so he's not going to be here this week.
I'd like to start with wish everybody a happy President Obama's Day. It's President's Day today.
You're provoking people, Gary.
Yes.
Yeah, I know. And that's why we keep him silent most of the time, because he says terrible things to Republicans and conservatives and you know, who don't recognize that President Obama is president, right?
Right.
In fact, the whole point of, I think, a lot of the last 4 years of politics is to delegitimize that he is president. They don't recognize it, and we're going to be talking about an issue coming up on it. But they didn't do it with Clinton either. They referred to Clinton as your president, not
right.
Our president. And I don't think, you know, Democrats got extremely, extremely mad at George Bush for the war in Iraq when there was no weapons of mass destruction there, and we caught 4,000 people killed, and it cost us trillions of dollars. But I don't think, you know, that as Democrats and independents, left or center, ever did that kind of trying to delegitimize the absoluteness that the Republicans have decided to do. Now, if you do too much of that, you know, then you get payback. And if you do too much of it, you can really undercut the central point or the central unity of a country. And we're living in a period of extreme polarization of the two parties that is very different than when Gary and I were young. And I think we want to talk today about the campaign, about the presidential campaign. But there's been some news, very important news, that'll play into the campaign in a big way. And that's the death of Antonin Scalia, the extremely right-wing Supreme Court Justice. And so Gary and I are going to tell you a little bit about what the impact of this on the election, but the impact on the legal situation. Because the court has been divided. There are 9 members. I think, when was it? It was one time had even more members, and then, I don't know.
No, it was actually smaller. Under FDR, it expanded to the present 9.
But in the 19th century, I think there were 11 members, and they cut it down to 9. Yeah. So it's not in the Constitution, the number of members in the Supreme Court. The Constitution just said there shall be a Supreme Court. But it doesn't say how many members or anything like that. But the court has been divided, 5-4. For a very long time, with an extremely conservative majority, and one in the old days, you had a court, you had some liberals over here, and you had some conservatives over here, and you had a lot of swing members. But this court has had a single swing member for many years, right, Gary?
Right, Judge Stevens, or Justice Stevens.
Yeah, and now Kennedy, Judge Kennedy,
right.
And Scalia has been sort of the intellectual leader of the farthest right on the court. And he has from the very beginning been brilliant, but also extremely unjudicial in the things he says about his fellow court members, the way he treats lawyers for the positions that he disagrees with. But let's talk a little bit about the impact politically. What happens now, Gary? The court is now 4-4, mm-hmm. 4 liberals, 4 conservatives. What happens? We bring to a really divisive or important case to the court. Pick a liberal one or a conservative one. What happens? What's the effect of this?
The effect is that whatever the previous courts, you know, the appeal court or the federal court, district court, whatever decision was made that got the case to the Supreme Court to begin with, will stand.
So if it's a 4-4 tie.
If it's a 4-4 tie.
Now, they can reconsider a case, and there are cases that seem liberal or conservative, or we probably shouldn't use that language too much, but there are controversial cases which they think can be settled, even with 4-4, that there'll be a swing vote on some of the issues. And it varies. It's a complicated thing, folks, because there are different circuits courts in the United States. And circuit courts are where everything gets appealed to before it goes to the Supreme Court. And there are ones that lean liberal, like the Ninth Circuit that we're part of here in Arizona, which is why the governor doesn't want to be part of it, because they overturned some of the nastier legislation in Arizona. And then there's a conservative mostly based Southern District, the Fifth Circuit. So the cases coming from the Fifth Circuit will have been decided in a very conservative way, and cases from the Ninth Circuit will be decided in a more liberal way. And so when these reach the Supreme Court, they have a different impact. If it's a 4-4 split, Gary, right, then the conservative decisions of the Fifth Circuit will stand, and the more liberal decisions of the Ninth Circuit will stand. We have some examples for folks.
Yeah, there's. I looked up the pending caseload, and there's some huge cases, important cases. For example, there's Fisher versus University of Texas, which is on affirmative action. It's a young white woman that was denied entrance to University of Texas. And she felt that she was, I think that the lawyers go in the political parties sometimes go looking for these cases.
Often they do. They often look for examples, and that's true of both the liberals and conservatives, the left and the right. They look for examples. You know, we don't know whether she's someone who was recruited to do this. We do know in a lot of cases they recruit somebody. From the legal point of view, it doesn't matter. In other words, yeah. We're a really arch-conservative group, and we have a point we want to make, and we recruit somebody who has legal standing in the case. That's legal. In the same way on the other side.
So this is about affirmative action, and one of the interesting little pieces to it is her grades didn't qualify her. So she's still angry, even though she didn't meet the requirements. She's still angry that someone of a different race who had met the requirements was admitted instead of her.
Okay, so how was the case decided in lower court, Gary? Did it go to the Supreme Court?
That I don't know. I don't remember how it was. I think it was upheld that Texas could keep her out. I didn't go back and look
There's a case in California where the Ninth Circuit ruled, and to have a strong union, you sort of need either everybody in the union or paying dues. If you don't have them, then a whole lot of people can opt out, and you do all the work and pay all the money, and you don't go anywhere. So that's the argument for having that if people don't want to join the union, they still contribute money to the process of negotiating with whoever you're negotiating with for wages and benefits. So there's a case there.
It's that one's called Friedrichs versus California Teachers, and it's whether or not public unions can charge non-member fees for collective bargaining.
Okay, so what's going to happen there has been decided, I believe, by the Ninth Circuit. And so if that goes to the Supreme Court, and there's a 4-4 tie, then it goes back to the Ninth Circuit. Now, here's what happens, folks. It's a little complicated. When the court decides that can't decide the case, the Supreme Court can't decide the case, then the standing law is the circuit courts before that. The Ninth Circuit, the Fifth Circuit, whatever it is. That's what stands. It does not stand as permanent United States law. It only stands until the Supreme Court rules on it. So, part of the thing is that once the court again has 9 members, then they'll take up a lot of these cases. So none of the cases that are decided 4-4 are going to be our permanent legislation in the United States. In other words, they are going to have to be re-argued somewhere down the line when you have a full court and you can have a vote. And that's going to be a lot of cases, we believe. In other words,
some big ones. The list. There's Puerto Rico financial crisis is on the docket. To allow Puerto Rico to enact laws to restructure its debt. As many people know, Puerto Rico is facing bankruptcy, a U.S. territory. There's a First Amendment case, Hefferman versus City of Paterson, New Jersey, that questions whether the First Amendment protects a government worker who was demoted because his boss thought he supported a political candidate.
So as a public employee, there's a general rule that in at least some states and some cities that you can't support one way, candidate or another. It's not a particular candidate that you can't support. You can't, as a public official or as a, there's usually not someone who, it's not someone who's elected or not someone who's appointed, but it's usually someone who's in the civil service, can't go out and take political positions. And so that's the case, right?
Right. There's a class action against Microsoft. The case is Microsoft versus Baker. It's whether or not the class action is applicable. There's another case, Tyson Foods versus, I can't even pronounce it, again is whether or not it's legal to bring a class action.
All right. So what's happened is we're in the middle of a presidential campaign. In the last year of a presidential campaign, and Judge Scalia has died of a heart attack on a hunting ranch in West Texas, near where my family's from, actually. So he died there, and that really changes things because the court has been so divided. And the thing about Scalia, brilliant as he was his extremely, I won't call him vicious, but his extremely pointed, to the point of being nasty and insulting, not only of people bringing something to the court that he disagreed with, but to the justices when they didn't decide the way he wanted.
And he refused to recuse himself in cases where he, for example, his wife was lobbying against Obamacare,
Justice Thomas.
Or was that Thomas?
That was Thomas. Scalia apparently was a pretty nice fellow when he wasn't on the court, but he dominated it by the extreme of his opinions. Now, there's a big argument about how to interpret the Constitution, and there are people who see it as a living document, changing with the times, interpreted within the frame of whatever is going now. First, you have the frame of when it was settled. That is the view of it when it was settled, and then you have the view now as the world changes.
He was an originalist.
Yes, but Scalia's argument was never that. And the really extreme right believes in doing the Constitution based on intention. But the problem with that, Scalia never supported that because how do you know what the intentions were? So Scalia supported this Constitution as an originalist in interpreting the Constitution just as the guys who argued publicly for a particular position did at the time. So then the Constitution is frozen in time, and he really hated the idea that it would be adjusted through time. It's 200 years old. It's just 3,000 something words. I don't have it before me. So he had a particular political interpretation of the Constitution. The Republicans, right, Gary, have said that they will not allow the president to replace him while he's in office.
Right. The
That's a silly thing to say while he's in office. But
before we get to that, I'd just like to point out that, you know, we have this really angry rhetoric between the two sides, particularly coming from the right. And I think one of the things that struck me about Scalia in reading this morning, David Axelrod, one of Obama's advisors, former advisors, talked about a conversation he had with Scalia early on when one of the justices had retired. And Scalia had actually requested that Obama appoint somebody smart. He knew he wasn't going to get somebody that was conservative, but he wanted somebody smart that was of an intellectual equal to he and some of the others on the court. And so he requested Justice Kagan to be nominated because he thought she was smart enough to take the role. Scalia was also good friends with the most liberal justice on the court, Ginsburg. They were very close friends. And I think it becomes he is somewhat of a model, as much as I disagreed with his politics, he's somewhat of a model of getting along with the other side and having an intellectual debate about the issues rather than a polarizing, angry, hateful, kind of arguments our politics have degenerated to.
His remarks were against people who disagreed with were pretty extreme and acerbic and insulting. And he started right from the beginning when he was, apparently, when Ronald Reagan, he was on the court for 30 years. When Ronald Reagan appointed him, he was looking for a justice that could gather the other justices around an opinion. And he was looking for a right-wing conservative guy to do this because Justice Brennan had done it for the liberal side of the court. And he appointed Scalia. Scalia was, of course, affirmed by the Senate. And what he got was a stand-alone guy who was never really cooperative with the other justices. And we're talking in terms of decisions and public decisions, not how he lived his private life. He may have been a very, very nice man in private. I have no idea, but probably was. But that was it's a little bit different than what Reagan expected. Reagan wanted one thing, and he got this really standalone, he's sort of like a polar guy, a guy who stands as a pole, stands his ground, makes no compromises with his conservative colleagues or his liberal, wrote tons of dissenting opinions, and he dominated the court. He's a very brilliant guy. He dominated the court for decades. Mm-hmm. So now he's gone. Things are going to change, even if we don't get a new appointment. But we do need to get to what's happening now politically.
Right.
Gary can tell us a little bit about that. The Constitution says, the president nominates a member of the Supreme Court with the, I've forgotten the exact word, the advice and consent of the Senate. And that's that. That's all it says. It doesn't say you have to do it within 20 days or anything like that, or that there has to be 9 justices or anything. It's very general.
The average length of time between the nomination of a president and the confirmation of the Senate, the average length of time is 2 months. And what I find fascinating,
much longer if you're a Democrat than if you're a Republican,
right,
isn't it, Gary?
If you look at what's happened with, especially with Obama as president, the Republicans have grossly delayed the number of confirmations. Under George W. Bush, for example, we had 16 judicial nominees that were subject to cloture votes. In other words, they were filibustered. Under Obama, we've had 35. We currently have, I believe it's 81 vacancies on the court, courts around the country, on federal courts. There's only 36 nominees for those vacancies, and the judges in the federal courts have been screaming to get these positions.
Chief Justice Roberts has complained about, he's a member of the conservative side of the court, has complained about not filling vacancies. So the Republicans have played hardball the whole time, and now they're saying that President Obama doesn't have the right to nominate a judge because he's in the last year of his presidency.
They're demanding that he either nominate somebody in the mold of Scalia or not nominate anyone at all.
Okay. So they say that there's precedent for this, and we did a little bit of research and looked back, and there's precedent for not accepting any presidential nominee in the last year, but it occurs in the middle of the 19th century.
Right.
It doesn't occur in the 20th century at all. So if you go back to the mid-19th century, I think it's in the 1850s, then you can find a precedent for doing something so extreme. But you have to go that far. I can say there is a precedent. It's just, 150 years old.
Well, and there was a confirmation in the last year of Reagan's.
Right. So in modern times, they've gone ahead and confirmed justices in the last year of the presidency.
Last I looked, the Constitution said we elected a president for 4 years, not for 3 years and 1 month. And so that's in essence what they're asking. Obama is a president until late January of 2017.
It doesn't say the justice will be appointed by the next president.
No, there's nothing in the Constitution that would prevent, or even remotely prevent President Obama from making a nomination.
It's the same hardball, almost destructive, or actually destructive, politics that the Republicans have practiced with Obama's presidency from the beginning. Obama, I think, was a bit naive. He went in there, he thought it would be a post-racial society. He's a black man, he's elected to the presidency. He had worked well with senators when he was in the Senate, with conservative senators, sort of like Justice Ginsburg and Scalia were friends. He had friends on the conservative side, and they worked together to get legislation through. Before we go on too much, remember that this 5-4 split that you see in the newspapers or hear on the radio or TV is actually fairly rare. Most of the cases are decided by a much larger majority. And so it's as if you only see the really controversial cases. The other cases are being decided 9-0 or 8-1 or something like this. They don't seem to make the news as these more divisive cases. So most cases going to the Supreme Court are going to continue like they've been, and there'll be a decision, and it'll probably be pretty lopsided. A lot of the cases going to the court are actually lopsided. I don't have the figures in front of me, but it's the majority of the cases.
They're generally, decided based on the law. This happens to be one of the most, if not the most, political courts in history, where you have a 5-4, conservative majority that is chosen to become very political with many of the decisions.
The most damaging court decision, I think, since Dred Scott back in the mid-19th century, was the decision of Citizens United. So that is probably going to be reconsidered. Now, the court is unlikely at any point to completely overturn that earlier decision, but there are all kinds of ways to moderate it. That would be the easiest way. Otherwise, to Citizens United... See, we have a problem in the United States. I think most people, right-wing or left-wing, know there's a problem with the way power is distributed in the country. And liberals and conservatives see it in different ways. But Citizens United enabled the very rich to basically have candidates on of their own. So we have a casino owner who made his money in very dubious ways in Macau. Is that how you say it?
Macau.
China, picking the presidential candidate, Newt Gingrich, and keeping him going with millions of bucks when nobody else was supporting him. So
we
most of the Republican
like
candidates, I don't know about. I know Bernie Sanders has no millionaires, but most of the other candidates, I mean, Rubio has spent his campaign with a single billionaire funding most of his activities. Ted Cruz, I think, has like five billionaires now pouring money into his campaign. So does Jeb Bush. You have someone like even on the right, far right, who doesn't have the money, and those guys have mostly dropped out. Santorum and Huckabee, without a billionaire, they just, you know, they didn't even get going.
My favorite, as long as we're talking about money, my favorite statistic so far is Jeb Bush has spent $82 million. Of his campaign finances, mostly from PACs and super PACs. Through the third quarter of last year, there's no figures on through the to this point for the rest of the campaign, but someone estimated he spent $280,000 per vote that he received in the Iowa caucuses, and he spent now something like $40 million in advertising in both Iowa and New Hampshire, and has ended up with something like three delegates.
The billionaires came out in both presidential campaigns, and President Obama won them both, even despite their effort. The last campaign, they particularly put a lot of money in. Where they're making inroads, and the Koch brothers are a good example, they are very secretive in terms of their contribution. Where they made inroads is in the state legislatures, and they're even looking at local elections for mayor and stuff. So the
school
far
boards.
Right is
school boards even
school boards. So they're pumping money in, and see, those are inexpensive. If you've got billions of dollars, those are inexpensive candidacies. The candidates don't have a chance to get known. You know, when you're running against President Obama and he's running for his second term, you either by then you probably know whether you support him or not, and you look at who he's running against and decide. But for a lot of positions, the people running don't have any television. They don't have any even radio. They don't have a print. And so the impact of money can be greater on the state level. And it's funneled through extremely secretive organizations. And we've seen that in the last elections in Arizona.
$40 million in plus in two states. When I was with large ad agencies with substantial advertising budgets, for large clients, if we had $10 million for a state, that was a big budget for a single state. You could dominate the television airwaves.
And we have our standing invitation to APS to come on the show and tell us and for the record that they didn't contribute any dark money to elect corporation commissioners. They're invited here. We'll put them on. We'll give them all the time they need. If they want to come on and tell us that they didn't do it, fine. But otherwise, the amount of dark money goes into a lot of campaigns. How many Republican candidates do we start with, Gary?
We started with 17.
17? Oh, my gosh. Do you have a list of the fallen candidates? How about the six guys who are remaining, or do you want to do the list of the fallen candidates?
Let's start with the fallen candidates. We've bid adieu or adios, whatever you want to say, to Chris Christie, Carly Fiorina, Jim Gilmore, Rand Paul.
Does anybody know who Jim Gilmore was out there? He was actually a good candidate. I don't think 1 in 10 Republicans ever even knew he was a presidential candidate.
He had been governor. I forget which state.
I believe of Virginia or Maryland.
Virginia.
He's
right.
The only one with any executive experience in government that was running the Republican Party.
Well, Chris Christie is.
Well, that's true. I'm wrong. Kind of a genuinely moderate Republican with
never stood a chance if you're moderate.
Well, go on, Gary. Who else?
Rand Paul, Mike Huckabee.
What happened to Rand Paul? He was supposed to be the dynamite libertarian dude.
Libertarian, yeah. He just never caught traction, either with fundraising or with the public.
Foreign affairs is very non-interventionist, and the Republican Party is dominated by extreme interventionalists. If one of their people is elected, you'll see more things, I think, like us going into Iraq. They want to go in. They believe there's a military solution. And if you look at Iraq and Afghanistan, there's some of us who are sort of skeptical that no matter how good your military is, that you can solve these things. But go on with the list, Gary, because I'm chafing at the bit here.
So Rick Santorum, Lindsey Graham, Rick Perry, Bobby Jindal, Scott Walker, and George Pataki. Those are the following. So we're left now with Donald.
I think we should do a test for Republicans if they can remember their 17 candidates.
Yeah. I don't know if anyone would pass.
I don't think anybody would remember Gilmore. He's probably the best of the lot, but go on, Gary.
We're left with Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, John Kasich, Jeb Bush, and Ben Carson.
Wow.
It's really a pretty depressing lot.
The debates have gotten really very high-minded, right, Gary? and intellectual and policy-oriented.
The last one was, I don't know if you watched it, but I could only stomach part of it, but it was a free-for-all, where people making wild accusations against their opposition. But it's kind of
interesting. Cruz particularly gets pissed off when people check his facts and they find out he just made it all up.
Well, PolitiFact and FactCheck.org and Snopes, the three major fact-checking organizations, have been having a field day with the Republican debates because, it's just one lie after another.
And it was an odd debate because Donald Trump was the subject of all the attacks. He was the focus of all the attacks, and they beat up on him for whatever hour.
Benito Mussolini of Republican candidates.
Yeah. So they beat up on Donald Trump, and Donald Trump started. Jeb Bush is in desperate straits. Gary was talking about how much money he spent. He's not gone anywhere. He's not a very good candidate.
Continues to try to defend his brother.
So he brought his brother in to save his campaign. He brought his mom in. Okay, because he's in serious trouble. And so Jeb is arguing, well, my brother was W, and he was great. He kept us safe. So then that got into an argument with Trump, who said, well, he basically tricked us into a war with Iraq that cost us all this money and all these lives. He lied to us. He didn't keep us safe because 9/11 happened on his watch, not on somebody else's watch. And people said, well, he sounds like a Democrat, but the conversation took a really odd turn where the thing is that they've done a poll. So Trump is arguing these things, most of which we agree with in terms of these particular areas about George Bush's foreign policy. And the problem Trump has, he's in South Carolina arguing this stuff. The majority of Republicans, I think it's something like 53 or 54%, believe, and this is reported as sort of straight stuff without comment, believe that there were weapons of mass destruction found in Iraq. So this is reported as if it's a matter of opinion. Well, I think they were, and the guys think I won't, but it's just not true. So the analysts are thinking, well, Trump is saying a lot of stuff that pretty much everybody knows, except the Republicans don't know that. We'll see what happens. I mean, he's saying, they didn't find any weapons of mass destruction. They caused all these casualties and all the trillions of dollars. I think he said $5 trillion. I don't know what the exact figure is. And we'll see what happens. But he's arguing it into a Republican base that believes a lot of really very, very strange stuff. Now, there's having an opinion. We could have an opinion. How much money should we spend? How many immigrants should we allow to come into the United States? We can have opinions about that, We like a lot. We like a few. We can have opinions about defense budget. Some people want a huge defense budget. Some people want a tiny one. Some people believe in intervention, and some people are very skeptical about it. Those are questions of opinion. There's also facts. And the fact is that they did not find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But if you've got the majority of Republicans believing that they did, the question is, they have a candidate in Donald Trump who's questioned that fundamental belief.
Yeah, it's really amazing. I said Trump is the Benito Mussolini of Republican candidates, and I swear, go on YouTube and look up Mussolini videos, and you'll see the same body language and posture between he and Trump. They're almost identical in that regard. You have Cruz whose wife recently said is running to show this country the face of the God we serve. And so he's going to institute Christian Sharia law.
Pretty much. I mean, he will, or at least he's pretending to do. They've checked, and he and his wife are extremely rich because we work with
Goldman Sachs,
yeah. Corporation Goldman Sachs, who some of our favorite people there helped bankrupt Greece and lots of other nice things. But his wife makes a lot of money there. And so they have a lot of money, and what they couldn't find on the tax returns for many years were any contribution to churches. So they're either very tight with their money, or maybe, are you think they're as religious as they now claim?
I don't know, but one of my favorite things with the Cruz campaign is his freshman roommate at Princeton when he was in college has been trolling him on Twitter. And with great humor, and some others from that era have joined in the new crews, and you know, there's a few Twitter quotes from his former roommate. Says, "I have 30,000 followers now, and all I had to do was be stuck in a room with Ted Cruz for a year. I'm sure you're all nice, but so not worth it." It says, "As a freshman, I would get into senior parties because I was Ted's roommate out of pity. He was that widely loathed. It's his superpower." He says, "I'm getting emails now blaming me for not smothering Ted Cruz in his sleep in 1988. He says, "Ted Cruz doesn't like New York values. His wife works for Goldman Sachs. This is how dumb he thinks you all are." You know, it's just been a joy to watch. If you're interested, you know,
we
it's
have Donald
Craig
Trump,
Mazin.
Donald Trump, who is amazing. Now, he ended up arguing all this stuff because I think he really has almost no real politics. He's just
no policy.
He just got backed into a corner with, you know, George Bush was a wonderful, wonderful president. He got backed into a corner, and so he said, no, he wasn't, you know. And I don't think he really even realized the implications of some of the foreign policy stuff.
He's making, you know, there was an article I was reading yesterday. He's making money off of his campaign instead of spending money. You know, they talk about how he's self-financing.
He is a genius of sorts.
How he's self-financing his campaign. Well, what he's doing is having his campaign contributors pay for his own companies for services. So if he flies somewhere, he takes his private jet. Well, he then bills the campaign for the use of his private jet.
Well, there you go.
You know, so he's actually made money so far.
So they jumped on poor Donald Trump, and but how did the debate go? Because we talked about Cruz, but Rubio's there now. A lot of people think, oh, Rubio is the replacement for Jeb Bush by the Republican establishment, right? He's a guy who is, you know, sort of moderate.
Marco Bott?
Yes. There's that, and there's the fact that his economic plan, if you look at the way money is distributed in the United States, and we can't show pie charts on the air, which is one of those round circles with chunks and going different ways, the top 1% of the 1% own a huge amount of everything. The top 1% own a huge amount more, and everybody else owns very little. And Rubio's plan would redistribute more money to the top. The entire benefits of his non-taxing, not the entire benefits, but I think there's like 30% would go to the rest of the people. All the rest of the benefits from his tax plan would go to the very rich.
It's the problem with the flat tax that a lot of these guys are promoting. I just like to say that the ratings are in from the polls are in from the last debate, and 32% of the debate watchers say that Marco Bott won the debate.
Okay.
24% thought Trump won, but his followers don't care what he says. They'll vote for him anyway. They've done research on him, and it doesn't matter what he says.
They like what he's doing and the way he's doing it more than what he's saying.
It's totally an emotional decision, not an intellectual one. 19% thought that Kasich won, 12% thought that Cruz won, 8% thought that Ben Carson stayed awake long enough to win, and 5% thought Jeb, you know, the guy with the most money and the most backing, 5%.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to understand Republicans sometimes as a Democrat. I admit that, I'm glad Kasich did that well. He's considered the most moderate of these characters, but
he's turning the other way now.
I know, and he's got economic policies that would really damage the United States. And one of them is he believes absolutely in balanced budget, which sounds nice. Balanced budget sounds nice, but when you get into a crisis or if you want to do anything, you have to borrow money, you know, that whether you're the government or you're borrowing money for a house, if you're going to, or a business, to start up a business, if you fall into what happened to us in the Great Recession, you have to be brave enough to go ahead and spend money, even if it puts you into a deficit, to get yourself out of it. And you can see the difference between, you know, the United States is not doing great, but it's doing a lot better than the European countries, who for all of being called socialists, went on a very, very conservative economic jag after the collapse. And the other thing is that the interconnectedness of the world, where we have some problems now because of China and stuff. But to return briefly, so who else do we have? We have Kasich, was pretty reasonable in the debate.
Kasich was relatively reasonable, but he just signed a bill to defund Planned Parenthood in Ohio.
So why do people think Rubio won? Because he really screwed up in New Hampshire and he acted better this time? He's very smooth.
I think they thought he was more moderate and I think the power of the party wants a moderate, you know, a relative moderate. There are none of these people that are wouldn't be classified in most circumstances as moderates. Mm-hmm. But the establishment wants Bush or Rubio or Kasich. They want one of those people to take the reins. They don't want Cruz and they don't want Trump.
And it looks like if they do badly that Carson and Bush may drop out after the South Carolina.
Well, they continue to pull in the single digits, so it's unlikely that they'll gain ground. Bush is putting all of his future on his brother, having W campaign throughout South Carolina. If he doesn't get into the double digits in South Carolina, he'll be gone. So will Carson. Carson's the darling of the evangelical crowd, he and Cruz.
He's faded so much. At one point, he was leading in the Iowa caucuses, very unrepresentative, but he was leading there, and now he's just sort of faded. So we're going to see probably some more candidates drop out. Do we have announcements, Gary?
Yes, we do. We have from our sponsors, Democrats of the Red Rocks, is having a meeting this coming Thursday morning at 8 a.m. at Old Sedona Bar and Grill. They have two speakers, Brent Bitz, who is with the Verde River Basin Partnership, and Paul Johnson, who is going to talk about the benefits of an open primary, of having, allowing independents and everyone to vote for during the primary for candidates.
This is an important issue that that needs investigation. Both Republicans and Democrats, some of them support it. You can get this program and all our programs on BVID.com podcast. You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.